From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist and have a practice in Los Angeles, and this is a show where every week we deal with various mental health issues from a more holistic perspective. We all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So we often talk about very challenging topics, things that are relevant in everyone's life, and tonight is no different, actually. We're going to be talking in a little bit with my guest, Harley Jane Kozak, who is an actress and now published author. And the topic tonight, the approach we're going to go into now is changing, making changes in our lives, sometimes in terms of what we call midlife crisis or midlife changes, and what it takes in terms of the courage it involves and the motivation behind it, things like that. And we're going to be talking with Harley in just a minute. But before I get into that, actually, I want to thank my listeners who tuned in last week as well as those that are listening now. Last week was my first week at this new time on Saturdays at 1 o'clock. And I was actually in Phoenix doing the show from the studio, and I felt so much like a talk show host with the headphones and the microphone and the engineer through the window, and it was just really a whole different experience for me, and I really want to thank. I want to thank my new engineer, Robert, also. And particularly I want to thank Michelle Kaur, who's been a real support for my show for 2 years now and has her own show on KXAM called In the Mix, which airs on Wednesday nights, I believe 8 o'clock Phoenix time. And she had me on as a guest this past Wednesday night talking about dating and relationships and a lot of issues like that. And I want to read to you a excerpt from an email that she got about the show from a listener named Dan. So Dan, if listening to her show motivated you to listen in today, I want to thank you for your comments here. And he wrote quite a bit about her show and dating and his relationships and what he's going through. And then at one point he said, anyway, this is a quote, anyway, your radio show was also interesting because I never received dating tips from a gay man. Not that there's anything wrong with that, it's just different but true. It actually made me look at their, meaning gay, relationships in a more warm and sympathetic way, if that makes sense. To be quite honest, I guess I never realized that when someone is gay, they would have the same struggles in a relationship as folks that are not. Dan, you got the whole premise. You got the whole thing in that one show, and I really appreciated you taking the time to write that. One of the things that I really have appreciated over the last couple of years is the emails I've gotten for my own show, for Tell the Truth Faster, as well as some of the callers calling in, because I'm very open about being a gay man who's a therapist. And not that this show is about gay issues, although I certainly have done those, my share of shows about that, but that I'm a therapist, I'm a human being, and that the topics are relevant to everyone. And callers I've gotten on this show to talk about issues they're having have been gay, have been heterosexual, bisexual, and I've really valued the feedback I've gotten from a number of people that really get the fact that human is human, relationships are relationships. We all are dealing with the same issues, and we're here not to be judging each other, but to have a sense of understanding and tolerance and connecting with one another, because we're all going through the same stuff and can celebrate our wins and our changes together also. So, Dan, thank you for that comment. And if you're listening in at any time, I hope we hear from you. So with that being said, I want to introduce my guest. And as I mentioned, her name is Harley Jane Kozak, and she has recently written a book, a novel called Dating Dead Men. It's a great title, actually, and if it doesn't jump off at you on the shelves, then you're not conscious. And she's going to be doing a book signing in Scottsdale at Poison Pen Bookstore at 4014 North Goldwater, I believe, this Tuesday night. Is that correct, Harley?
That is correct, Stuart.
You need to speak into the phone a little bit more.
Okay.
That's better.
All right. Is that better? Good.
Yeah. Welcome
to the
show.
I'm on a headset, which the headset is a new experience for me.
Okay.
I'm a low-tech person. But anyway, thank you. I'm delighted to be on your show.
And that was correct. It's this Tuesday night.
It is
doing
this Tuesday.
Signing?
Yes, and I think that's the 16th.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
At what time?
7 o'clock.
At 7 o'clock. So, as you're listening to the show, listening to Harley and listening to some of the things we're talking about may motivate you to go down there this Tuesday night and actually meet her and hear her do a little bit of a reading, which I'm actually going to do tonight on the show, because there was a few things, a few excerpts that I really got tickled by. So, again, welcome. Harley and I actually met, when was it, about 8 months ago?
Yeah, I think it was in November is what I remember.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. At a workshop by Joel Roberts, a well-known former radio talk show host from Los Angeles, and there were a lot of us there dealing with a lot of different media issues, some of us hosts, some of us writing books, some of us trying to get out there and promote ourselves, and it was an incredible group of people. In fact, Harley, you may know that I had Gary Scott on as a guest.
Oh, he's an incredible guy.
Amazing, amazing, and the show is incredible, too. So, let's get to you. Tell us a little bit more about you. The basic thing I can tell the people myself is you have been an actress most of your childhood, as well as adult career.
That's
and,
true.
And here you are in, can I say 40s?
Yes, you can say 40s. Back, Stuart, I'll say it for you. I'm 47.
47 years old, and it didn't sound like you were going through a midlife crisis. It just sounded like at midlife you were reassessing and reevaluating things and decided to make some changes. Is that the way I read it?
You know, that's actually, that is the sort of airbrushed version, but as a matter of fact, as I'm thinking back, as I was just listening to your introduction, I did have a midlife crisis,
okay.
And I think it was a pretty classic one.
Uh-huh.
It happened to me when I was maybe about 37 or 38 years old. I was going through a dark night of the soul. I had just been dumped by a boyfriend, the last in a long succession of boyfriends. His parting words to me, and you have to imagine this with a French accent because he was French, he said, "The thought of marriage and children makes my blood run cold." And because we had started out, you know, with the idea that we were going to get married and have kids, this, of course, was really bad news to me. And my biological clock was ticking, and I was very much in love with this guy. So that was happening. My career was hitting a slump, as sometimes happens with actors in their late 30s. You know, you're used to playing like the leading lady or leading man, and suddenly you are the parents, the mom of the leading lady. For women, it's a little bit, you know, tougher than it is for men frequently, because men hit their stride at that point.
Yeah, for men to start playing the moms of the leading lady, that's a little bit difficult for some of them to handle.
It is difficult unless they're very emotionally stable, of course.
Right.
But so I was basically having a really bad life, and I couldn't seemed to see any progress in my relationship pattern. It's not like I could say, well, at least this last one was better than the one before. It all seemed to be like in this kind of, you know, just undifferentiated slump for me. So,
can I stop you for a minute? Because I have a question I'm really urged to ask. The therapist in me, when you made that quote by your ex-French boyfriend,
yes,
did you hear it as, "The thought of getting married and having kids with you makes my skin crawl," or was it just his issues that you were able to separate from?
You know, I think that I did understand pretty well that it was his issues. He had a child. already, a 12-year-old, and he felt like he wasn't being a very good dad to his 12-year-old. He also felt like his ex-wife and that dynamic was horrible. His ex-girlfriends were, he felt like he was in a bad place, but I also heard it as, you know, that he didn't want to get married to me. That I guess in my head, if I were the perfect woman, then his issues would sort of solve themselves and, you know, we'd go off into the sunset together.
That's the point. Because that's what most of us do. We personalize anything instead of being able to, you know, as an old phrase in a lot of, recovery programs is consider the source.
Yes.
And it's hard to do that sometimes when the source is somebody who's unresolved with past relationships and who's dealing with a lot of issues. It's hard to consider the fact that it's their problem and it's not mine.
Yes.
But then we go into the confidence issue is, why did I get involved with someone? Why didn't I pick up these cues? Where did
you
go with
exactly.
that?
Exactly. And because he'd come into the relationship just maybe 6 months earlier saying, I'm very open to getting married, I want to have kids, and this was a recurring theme in my life, meeting men who said, you know, on the first date really, I'm interested in having children, that's, you know, because it was clear that was something that I wanted to do. And yet he was having these second thoughts down the road a little bit, and this was true of many men in my past. And so I thought, you know, there's got to be, since I am the common denominator in all my relationships, there has to be something in me that's you know, going astray here, that's meeting men who seem to be open to this, who then, you know, kind of bail out on the idea of, you know, long-term commitment. And it can't be all men. There's got to be something else going on here. So I had kind of a breakthrough in one of my very dark moments, and that was this, that I actually started out pretty, you know, happy-go-lucky in relationships, but as I started to fall in love with men, I made myself more and more perfect, or what I conceived of as, you know, the perfect girlfriend, and what that entailed for me was hiding the parts of myself that were in any way needy, or that I had a judgment about, that, well, he's not going to like it if I say this,
mm-hmm.
or if I am this way, and I have to always, you know, show up and suit up and be as perfect as I can be. And I think in the process of hiding myself like that, they fell out of love with me.
Mm-hmm.
And
or they weren't falling in love with who you really were. And sooner or later, that mask falls off.
That's very true. And I think that at first, before my feelings were really engaged, I was myself in all of these relationships, which was very appealing to men. And then as I tried to become more perfect, I became actually more bland or something, whatever it was. And I don't think that any of these men really consciously realized this, but I think that, you know, they just weren't, their feelings weren't engaged because I was not showing them, you know, all my sides. And I think because if you took a survey among my old boyfriends, I think they would say, you know, she was a great girlfriend. I don't know. It just wasn't quite right. Didn't quite work out.
Now, that need to be perfect is not something that usually shows up just in adulthood. Is that something that went back to your childhood? Was that your role in the family early on, being the perfect kid and doing the right things and taking care of everyone?
I think it was, because I was the youngest of 8 kids. My father died when I was 1. So my mom was the single mom to 8 children, and my very early memories were of, you know, realizing that there are things you can't bother mom with because that will upset her. We can't afford that, so don't even ask. There was a sense that we were a family that was, you know, in danger of going under in some sense, and that we all had to, you know, be really good sports and good campers and keep it together. And, you know, I think we all did to a great degree. And, you know, we're all kind of dealing with the after effects of that now in our adult lives.
And where did being the baby of 8 come into play? I would think that there's a possibility that being the baby, in order to maintain she's cute and she's adorable and it's great having this baby here, you really had to continue playing out that role and meet people's needs as the youngest and the cutest and the adorable one.
I think that's really possible. That sounds kind of right to me. And as my mom described it, I seemed to sense right from the beginning that she was tired and that she needed someone who wouldn't give her any problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really who I was. And she you know, she describes the first year of my life as being that sad year, because that was the year that my father got sick and eventually died. So she said that I was, you know, a big comfort to her, and I think that I kind of took that on, as I think so many children do. They perceive a need in their parents, and they think, well, I can fill that, I can do that. And it's, you know, maybe it's really not their job as children to play those parts.
Definitely not their job, yeah. It's the parent's role to be taking care of the kid, and there you were at a year old being the caretaker, and in a sense, or at least the beginning of your life, you lost both of your parents for a while.
Oh, I think I very definitely did. And I think this is something that happens now that I'm a mom and I'm having, you know, my own challenges in dealing with three very small children and those demands. I think of my mom all the time now and think, how the heck did she get through that? How did she do that?
There's eight of them.
eight children. And how did everybody in those days, because big families were very much more common in those days. And I think that to a large degree, there was more extended family. Certainly that was true for us. But I think also the older kids tend to take care of the younger kids. And as a result, I'm much closer to my siblings than I was to my mom in many ways, because those were the people who put me to bed at night and read me stories and got my lunch together and took me to school and did so many of the things that I do now for my children. And, you know, I think I've made my peace with that to a large degree, but I think my mom missed out on a lot of my growing up, you know, due to circumstances, not just being a single mom, but being the mom to so many kids.
Right.
And I think that was a great sadness in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she did a very good job of holding it together for us in so far as keeping a roof over our head, making sure that we had, you know, good educations and really taking care of us in all the, you know, the classic ways that people need to be taken care of. But I think that inevitably emotional needs suffered.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think there's any way to meet the needs of all those kids.
Right. Is she still alive?
No, she died about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And did you or any of the siblings get a chance to acknowledge her directly for being aware and conscious of what you just said?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
When I was about 28, I got sober. And that opened a Pandora's box of issues because when I got sober, I had to sort of look at the ways in which I was using alcohol and drugs to maintain that kind of, you know, perfect role that I had cast myself in. And staying sober entailed looking at a lot of stuff that I had just buried my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, really unpleasant for my mom to hear. My mom had no idea that I was into alcohol and drugs because one of her coping mechanisms was to go to bed early, which is so understandable to me now as a mom. You know,
right.
Of course, you know, if you get 8 hours of sleep, you're going to cope a little better. But so I was, you know, I think my life, my childhood was a lot of benign neglect, which was a really wonderful way to grow up in so many ways. And I think a lot of my creativity comes from that. But I think that I also was, you know, had a lot of unsupervised experiences and, you know, for whatever reason that gave me the addictive kind of personality that I have, I had to look at a lot of issues in order to maintain, you know, get through a day without having a drink.
But it's also, the word neglect is still in there, and that's painful for anybody to feel like they're not being seen, they're not being heard, they're not being cared for, and in a sense of, no matter what I'm doing here, even if I'm going down a deep hole here, nobody really sees it or is willing to intervene.
Yes, and you know what? My mother would have intervened in a second had she known about any of this. But I think it was part of my, you know, my way of loving my mom was to keep things from her that would worry her. And my mom was fairly adept at not asking questions if she knew she wasn't ready to hear the answer. So that was kind of how we got through, you know, life in many ways. And actually, I think that was, you know, that helped us get through some very tough times. However, it did, you know, it did take its toll. And at one point, I woke up and found myself in, you know, leading a life that I really didn't want to be leading, which was the life of an alcoholic and drug addict.
But knowing it, addicts as I do and working with them as long as I have for like 30 years, it wasn't just a way of loving your mom. It was a way of doing what your family did, which is not acknowledge the elephant in the living room,
yes.
And to deal with your own shame and guilt by trying to hide everything as best you could. And hopefully, you know, most addicts don't want people to notice that they're doing that until they do start attempting recovery.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, I appreciate, really, your openness about this, because that's something I didn't know about you, was your recovery, and I really, really commend you for it. And that makes the transition that you're talking about all the more empowering, I think, and I'm really glad you're talking about it, because not only did you effort the recovery, but effort some really true healing inside, and, you know, that's scary enough for most people, making that change of letting go of the drugs, the alcohol, the sex, or whatever it is that they were addicted to, and risk stepping off that cliff and trying something new. And for the first step, it's about getting sober and being in recovery. For you, then, it was about actually having a life in sobriety.
Yes.
Which was family and a career, and if the career of acting wasn't working, you said, you know what, there's something else I'd rather do more. And there are a lot of addicts, even in recovery, that I know who are afraid even to take the risk of making changes like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a very scary thing. But in my case, the career change came very gradually.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, because I got sober at 28, which was, I get, now as I look back on it, that seems pretty early to me. So I actually had the best years of my acting career in sobriety. And that was a big deal. It was a big deal for me to realize that I could act sober.
Mm-hmm.
Although I never had actually acted drunk, my alcoholism had not progressed to that degree. I would act hungover, but I would never actually be drunk while I was working, because I was working through all this. But I would say that my career was the most successful for the next 10 years. It was actually 10 years into sobriety, which is another issue, I think, is that there's something very, very thrilling about getting sober once you get over the initial, you know, nightmare of, oh, my gosh, I'm never going to have a drink again.
Mm-hmm.
And getting, you know, through that kind of thinking into one day at a time, putting a day together and another day together. Once you get over the thrill of being sober, then you have to do, like, you know, maintenance, which is a whole other feeling. And so my career was great, and then it started to shift into this, you know, midlife stage. And that's when it became a lot less creatively fulfilling. It just didn't use up all of me. And so I started to take a writing class, it was just a creative writing class, and we did a lot of literary fiction reading and writing. And then one of my essays in the class just started to grow into a novel. So then I started doing a lot of classes in how to write novels. And I think that one of the qualities that has served me really well in life is that I really like going to classes and being a student. So I have, I think it's Buddhism that talks about beginner's mind. And I really enjoy taking on a new subject about which I know nothing, and I have a fair ability to make a fool out of myself and live with that. So that has really helped me going through a career change, is to to take on something where it's like learning to ride a bike all over again. It's just really hard until you get the hang of it. But I sort of stuck with writing my first novel for almost 10 years, which is a pretty long time to write a novel.
Yes.
Yeah. So that puts me, you know, so I started when I was about 37 or so. I was sitting on the set and of whatever movie I was doing at the time, and I kept working through all of this, and I kept dating through all of this. I was, you know, trying to get this, my personal life together, and through the course of those 10 years, my career started to slow down. My relationships after this kind of breakthrough I had improved dramatically, and the next guy I met became my husband.
Wow.
Which was, you know, just one of the big events of my life, obviously. Like, you know, after getting sober, this was the next really big deal, was to meet my husband and to make a really conscious decision to do this one differently. And then I started having children, which is also something that's a real issue when you're pursuing the career of an actress. So So it was a very natural segue for me to taper off my acting career and sort of step up my writing career.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, I want to talk about that balancing of career and family a little bit more about the book itself. And I'm actually going to read to you. I don't know if anybody's ever read your book to you, but there's a few paragraphs here that I was really tickled by. So this is Stuart Altshuler. You're listening to Tell the Truth Faster. And we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back with Harley Jane Kozak.
The rainbow
way. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and today we're talking with Harley Jane Kozak, actress and most recently a well-received novelist, the author of Dating Dead Men. And Harley actually will be in Scottsdale this Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the Poison Pen Bookstore doing a book signing and reading, and that's at 4014 North Goldwater in Scottsdale. Harley, tell us a little bit about the book, a short synopsis, and then I'm going to read a few paragraphs from an excerpt here, and how these characters developed for you, and how much of yourself are in there, which I often ask a writer.
Okay. This is a book about a woman named Wally Shelley. She's a greeting card designer. She is dating 40 men in 60 days as part of a scientific research project for a radio talk show therapist, who is, coincidentally...
Not me, though.
Not me, Stuart. It's she's actually based on a very dear friend of mine who is a radio talk show therapist, and this one is writing a book called How to Avoid Getting Dumped All the Time. So she's having women do research for her to be used as case studies. So Wally is one of these women. And so she's dating as fast as she can, but she's doing it to earn money to buy her greeting card franchise. And she's not falling in love with any of these guys, and she's actually a little bit not very optimistic about the prospects of true love until she is on her way to the state mental hospital where her brother lives as a paranoid schizophrenic, and she runs into a dead body in the road. Because of a combination of circumstances, she is compelled to figure out who this dead body is and who killed him, and this puts her in league with a mysterious stranger who's dressed like a doctor who she meets in an elevator and does, in fact, fall in love with. So this is a comic suspense, if you haven't figured it out. And it is a novel. It's not autobiographical, but I did have personally about 50 blind dates.
Okay. And it would make sense to me that it's a comic suspense murder mystery because my experience of you, even at Joel Roberts' workshop and stuff, is you have a really good sense of humor.
Oh,
and you're really out there. So with that in mind, I just want to read about three or four paragraphs from the excerpt on your website. And Mr. Bunt is the guy representing the franchises who's come to her shop to evaluate it for whether she can actually buy it. So it's quoted, "I walk Mr. Bunt out to his Lincoln Continental, chatting to divert his attention from his surroundings. The shop was on Sunset Boulevard, east of Highland, smack in the middle of a small strip mall comprised of a 21-hour locksmith, a mini-mart called Bodega Bob, Lu Fang's Chinese fast food, Neat Nails Plus, and a Colonel Sanders knockoff Plucky Chicken. The good thing about the location was there were no other greeting card shops for 2.7 miles. The bad news was this little piece of Hollywood was not optimum in terms of sales. Seedy, an old boyfriend once called it. Frederick put it another way. It's like your shop was headed for the suburbs and got off at the wrong bus stop. That's the light I love. It wasn't the prettiest corner of the world, but I couldn't afford the franchise if it was. My philosophy was hookers need greeting cards, too. There were no hookers this morning, just a man sleeping in a wrecked red Fiero in front of Lu Wang's when Mr. Bunt by the grace of God, seemed not to notice. Corporate policy stated my jurisdiction included the shop and all public areas connected to it, but you can't really dust and vacuum people. I love that, and
thank you.
The humor in there. I mean, like I said, when you called me earlier, I was laughing in that moment when you called about the bus stop. They're getting off at the wrong bus stop. You also go on in that, and I'm not going to read it, but you start talking about the character's paranoid schizophrenic brother, and even the meds he's on, and the waves of lucidity and paranoia and things like that that I'm assuming she's dealing with throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
As a therapist who actually takes a lot of issues with how mental illness and therapists are depicted in the media, usually I get very angry with TV shows that make the therapist buffoons,
right.
Or they're sleeping with their clients, or they're the serial killers in the end,
right.
Type of thing. It does not encourage people to want to go into therapy. So the fact that it's really a pet peeve of mine, but from the little I read in this one excerpt, it feels to me like you did your homework on paranoid schizophrenia, and tell me how you did that homework and what you learned from it and how you ended up presenting it in the book.
I did a fair amount of research on paranoid schizophrenia because even though it's not a large part of the book, it's a storyline that is it's like a B or a C story, I guess you'd call it in Hollywood terms. I still wanted to get it right, especially because I write a comic novel. I wanted to not make light of mental illness.
Bless you.
And I wanted to not condescend to it or use it as like the punchline of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very, very interested in portraying someone whose life is touched by severe mental illness. I think that the families of the mentally ill live a life, along with people who are caregivers, who deal with, you know, aging parents or, you know, children with learning disabilities. I think so many people out there are living in you know, with the shadow of this or this as part of their daily reality, and it's not something that is talked about very much. So I wanted this to be a component of my character's life, that she has a brother, she's responsible for him legally, and he lives in a mental hospital, and he's got this disease of paranoid schizophrenia. Personally, how I did this was I read a lot of books to begin with. I know a fair amount of people who are psychologists, psychiatrists, and psychotherapists because of my best friend and also because of my own experiences in therapy as an actress. And so I actually just phoned a few people and said, do you know people I could talk to? So I actually toured some mental health facilities. I met probably about a dozen people with this particular disease. I don't know why I chose this disease. Actually, I don't have any personal experience of it, but it just came to me that this is what this guy had, was paranoid schizophrenia, rather than bipolar or a few others that I started to look at. This just suited my needs as a novelist the best. So then I just set out to learn everything that I could about it, including the treatment for it. And I have a brother who lives in Oregon who works with people who have this and other diseases that make them pretty high functioning. And he helps them in terms of getting jobs and living on their own in an apartment,
right, yeah.
And stuff like that. So I went up to Oregon and hung out with him and, you know, met with his clients and also attended the families of the mentally ill, a meeting of a support group of families, and just heard what their concerns were and what it was like to live with that. Because I wanted, even though that's not a large part of the book, I wanted it to be as accurate as I could get it.
I really respect that a lot. And I appreciated your attitude about, you know, not just making it a butt of jokes the way, I mean, there's a new sitcom on that just came on Fox that really got my dander up in terms of, you know, a real dysfunctional family where all of them have another diagnosis and a grad student's moved in to be their therapist, which is totally unethical and, you know, it's like, it's like this is not the way therapy is done, and this is not what most people going to therapy are like, and it shouldn't be made but of the jokes, unless it's those people themselves making light of it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, you know, thank you for that. Have you gotten any feedback from people who have read the book who have related to how you handled the paranoid schizophrenia or people themselves?
Yes, actually a friend of my sister's who lives in Lincoln, Nebraska read it and said, you got it exactly right. And her brother actually was someone who I visited in his hospital and, you know, just hung out with for a few hours and so that I could get the, you know, really I had the character of PB, who is the guy in the book who has schizophrenia, was pretty clear in my head, but I just needed a lot of reinforcement that, you know, when it comes down to dialogue and how his thought processes work, you know, that's the creative part, trying to think, you know, what is this disease, how does it work in the brain, and how would that affect his thought patterns and speech patterns. Anyway, so she said I got it right, and so, you know, that's great, but of course, you know, every paranoid schizophrenic is different from every other one.
Right.
So I can't claim that I got it right for everybody, but I've had no negative feedback, so I, you know, I'm very happy about that.
Excellent. Excellent. To switch gears here a little bit, balancing career and family. I mean, you talked about at a certain point in your life, your career was really most of your life except for these real dysfunctional serial dating you were doing. Then you meet Mr. Wright, get married, and in quick concession, you had one child and then a set of twins.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so you have young kids. You've given birth to a book.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've read in your bio, you sound like you're going to be doing the books in quick succession, too, just like the kids.
Yes, I just turned in the sequel. Yeah, the first book took 10 years. The second book took 15 months. So
wow.
I had to learn to, you know, well, as you would say, Stuart, tell the truth faster.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, hopefully, you know, a third book is going to be written, you know, just that fast, too. So
how are you balancing this? How are you doing the kids? And what kind of support do you have from your husband and anyone else? I mean, how is all this working for you? Because I know a lot of people are afraid to add something else to the mix because they just feel they're already so overwhelmed. How does that support system get set up to you?
You know, there's a lot of different components to it, obviously. And I really wish my mom were alive because I want to call her so often and say, how did you do this? And I think that I don't have any, like, you know, novel answers for anybody, but how it's worked for me is, first of all, I have a husband who is extremely supportive. He knew when he married me that he was marrying a pretty constantly working actress, but he knew right away that I had aspirations to write novels and also that I wanted children and that probably when we had children I would want to scale back on my acting. So, you know, we had all those conversations up front, and I really married someone that is so genuinely secure in himself that if I were to become like the biggest best-selling author on the planet and earn $2 million a year, it would not affect his self-esteem at all. He would say, you know, yippee, and maybe quit his job. But I think that was really, really important for me, and I really had my eyes open to find somebody that would not be threatened by any degree of success that I could achieve. And so it's not that I've achieved it yet, but I really feel that he's okay with that. And he does everything that he can to, you know, to support me, I would say, on every level that I can think of. Now, that said, he is an extremely hardworking attorney. He's a partner in a law firm that's, you know, very big. He works a lot. He travels a fair amount, and he works really long hours. So for me, it's, you know, absolutely vital to have help. And I didn't have it so much with my first child until I got pregnant with my twins, and then I needed help because a twin pregnancy has got its kind of own peculiarities. But then once the babies were born, I really needed help almost around the clock because there's a technical difficulty in having twin infants that any mother of twins is probably familiar with. But I would say that if I did not have help, I would not have been able to write the novel, to finish the novel, which
help
is essentially...
Help in terms of, like, a nanny or...
Yes.
Okay.
In our case, we have an au pair,
uh-huh.
Which is someone who comes to live with you for a year, like an exchange student. And so now we have Anya from Germany, and last year we had Uli. And we just love our au pairs so much. And we also had help. My Aunt Sandy actually, my husband's Aunt Sandy came and lived with us for the first 3 weeks of the twins' birth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some family members helped out, but we don't have any family members that are really local except for a niece of mine. So we've had to really find, you know, a succession of babysitters to help. And this causes me such guilt and anxiety sometimes that it's really, really tough. And I have so much compassion now for working moms everywhere and for stay-at-home moms everywhere that I never had as a single woman. I had no idea what women go through who are juggling family and career.
Mm-hmm. And who don't necessarily have the financial resources to have that kind of help.
Oh, I would say in most cases they don't have
right.
the finances.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are dependent on daycare, which I think is, I mean, don't get me started, but, you know, my political views are really pretty militant because I feel that our country is really, you know, behind most developed countries in terms of, you know, helping out children everywhere. So,
right, and providing more regular daycare for working mothers who really need it. And so, you know, if they can get off welfare, I think our political views on that are very similar.
Yeah, I
and
think
I'm glad
so.
You're angry about it because
I'm really mad about
become
it.
More and more visible, you know, you could be one of those celebrities who take a stand and help raise a different level of consciousness to that because it's something that touches you more personally.
It does. And you know what's a kind of a funny thing that I've discovered is that moms, although we are, I think, the you know, like a huge segment of the population, we're not organized in any political sense. Like retired people have a political, you know, lobby. The AARP is a very powerful one. People in most industries have lobbyists in Washington, D.C., but there is no lobby for moms because we're so busy that we don't have time to organize and get ourselves, like, together and get a lobbyist to go to Washington and knock on the door of the senators and say, hello, what about that, you know, family leave bill? And it's just kind of that a funny, paradoxical situation. There is no organization. It's like every mom is out there, I'm assuming, thinking she's the only one who's dealing with this.
Well, I think most moms don't have time to go looking for it, like you said, in terms of support system, but I have a feeling most of them realize they're not the only one out there. It's just that when they're alone with it, they feel like they're the only one in the world.
Right.
And feel so isolated and feel so unsupported, and it gets demoralizing. And I think
that's
evidence of these moms turning to drugs or alcohol or child abuse or abandonment and things like that. Everyone has a breaking point.
I think that's got to be true.
Yeah. Without the proper support, you know, everyone's human, and they're going to reach a breaking point if they don't get help or don't have a support system around them.
Yep.
So we're coming down to the final lap here and stuff. Is there anything else you wanted to say about the book or about any of the issues or other issues that we haven't talked about that, you know, we can do in the last few minutes here?
Oh, you know, there's something I wanted to say, like going back to my own mom. My mom had a really hard time when I got sober because it sort of made her realize that I'd had problems that she'd been unaware of, which I think for a mom is a really hard thing to hear, that their children have been suffering in silence. And it was very hard for my mom to face this and to hear myself call myself an alcoholic, and that brought up issues of her own, you know, childhood and her own father. And I have to say that 10 years into my sobriety, my mom had made such progress as the mother of an alcoholic and became such a supporter of, you know, my life in sobriety. And it was kind of a long haul because I went from her perfect kid to being a very not perfect kid, to being like a family rabble-rouser. You know, I was raising issues that nobody had wanted to talk about for a while. And then after a while, it just got better. You know, it wasn't immediate, but my mom, I think she was so open-minded, and by the end of her life, I think she was willing to look at everything, including things in her own childhood, in a way that to me was a real affirmation of how things can work in sobriety. And I guess that's I want to acknowledge my mom for that, and I was able to do that before she died, which was a really wonderful thing.
That's great. that's really great, and great that, you know, you had that experience, because I know a lot of people in recovery, you know, with a dysfunctional family system where one is consciously identified or even subconsciously in that role, very often when they make changes and get into recovery, the system doesn't know how to incorporate a healthier cog in the system. And so very often it becomes too much of a struggle for that person in recovery to maintain it and still be a part of the family.
But, you know, a great thing is usually if you ask around, you can find maybe one or two allies, and that's all it takes. And in my case, I had seven brothers and sisters who were extremely supportive. Even the ones who didn't really understand what I was going through, they were really supportive, and it was a really, really helpful thing for me, and I'm sure it contributed to my staying sober.
I have a suggestion that came up for me when you were talking about wishing you could still call your mom and ask her questions and, you know, talk to her through a lot of the things that you're going through right now. And a technique that I've used and I've, you know, had a number of clients use is, since you're a writer in particular, to write her letters.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And ask her the questions you want to ask her. And when you're done writing the letter to her, take a breath and have her write "Dear Harley," and just let your mind separate out and write a letter, stream of consciousness, or just don't think about it. Just see what starts coming out on your computer or out of your pen. And a common way to do this also is, like, are you left-handed or right-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Write the letter to her with your right hand, and then put the pen in your left hand, and let her respond from that side of the brain.
Oh, great.
It's a very interesting process and a very interesting tool. For a lot of people, it's kind of like the inner child when you switch to your non-dominant hand, so you can actually talk to a younger version of yourself, but it can also work even writing to someone who's not around anymore. If you try it, I'd love to hear from you whether you're getting some responses from her.
I bet I will. My mom was a great believer in the afterlife, so I'm sure she's just looking for a channel to come back.
Yeah, she wants you to open that door.
Yeah, I think so.
So if you do it and you're surprised by some of it or not, let me know, because I'd really like to hear what kind of results and what kind of information she's been sending you.
I will.
Okay.
I will do that.
It really can be a useful tool. So,
I think I'd also like to just say in closing that although we've been talking about, like, fairly serious subjects here, Stuart, my book is actually a comedy. So it's kind of a beach book. So if someone is looking at it as a, you know, self-help book, or since, you know, the title is Dating Dead Men, it can be perceived, I guess, as a self-help book. But it's actually not. It's actually a novel, and kind of a, you know, lighthearted one at that.
Well, when I first asked you to be on the show, you said, well, you know, how can I do some shameless promotion of my book and dealing with the mental, you know, your shows about mental health and things like that? And to me, there's always a hook in terms of mental health issues with anything. And I don't, I mean, you are a font of information about life's journey and about change and growth and empowering yourself in the world, and to me that's the focus, and your book is a result of that.
Yeah,
and so
it is.
There is no shameless promotion here. It's all appropriate promotion. I'm actually going out today and buying the book, and I'm certainly intrigued about reading it after reading the excerpts on your website, and I let people know that if they want to get in touch with you, ask you questions, find out more about you or the book, and know how to order it even online, they can go to www.harleyjanekozak.com. And Harley is H-A-R-L-E-Y, Jane, as in J-A-N-E, and Kozak is K-O-Z-A-K.
Yes.
And so it's harleyjanekozak.com. And if you didn't write that down very easily, you can get through to her or me by going to www.tellthetruthfaster.com. And there should be, if it's not already up there, a hyperlink to her website and a place to email me or Harley on that. And very soon the archives will be current with all the past shows I've done over the last 2 years. Somebody's actually working on editing the more current ones now. So it's a service if there's a topic on depression or relationships or anything I've done over the last 2 years. People go on there and actually listen to the whole show and listen to whatever guests I had or listen to the callers that have called in. So your show, Harley, hopefully within the next couple of weeks will be up there, and you can always make it part of your own promotional stuff by telling people to go to that website and listen in on what you had to say.
Great. Thanks, Stuart.
Yeah. So with all that being said, we're about ready to close down here for this week. This is Stuart Altshuler. And inviting you to tune in over the next few weeks. I'm going to have some very interesting shows dealing with women and AIDS and a number of other issues. I invite you to call in, write in. If you're too shy to actually call in, feel free to go onto the website and ask me some questions that I'll be more than glad to answer on the air related to anything dealing with mental health issues, problems you're having in your own life. And it's my forte, and I enjoy doing it. I'd also, again, like to thank Michelle Kaur and invite you to listen to her show, In the Mix, on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock right here on KXAM. And I want to thank Dan for writing in that comment and knowing that we can all learn from one another no matter what our backgrounds, no matter who we are. We're all here as fellow teachers and fellow guides to one another. So I want to thank Harley Jane Kozak, and again, invite you all to her book signing and reading on the 16th, this Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at Poisoned Pen in Scottsdale at 4014 North Goldwater. So that's it for this week. This is Stuart Altshuler. Thank you for listening in, and listen to us again next week on Saturday at 1 p.m. Phoenix time. So see you next week. That I